Morning, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Justice Jacobs, Your Honors. Donald Wolf for Vanguard Trust, the Vanguard Trustee Defendants. As the Court, I believe, is aware, and for reasons that I suspect are obvious, we have fractionalized our time on the defense side. And because there's little time to waste, we thought it might be most efficient for me to do the introductions and to present the lineup card for all of the Vanguard defendants. So with the Court's permission, I'll do that. With me this morning for my clients, the Vanguard trustees, is my co-counsel from Sullivan & Cromwell, Amanda Pflug Davidoff. Ms. Davidoff will present argument on our behalf and proposes to take 15 minutes in which to do so. My friend Mr. Lafferty from Morris Nichols Arston Tunnel will speak on behalf of the Vanguard Group defendants and proposes, with an economy of language seldom seen in this court or any other, to take 2 minutes in which to do so. And also present, and I think well known to the Court, is Louis Lazarus of Morris James Hitchinson Williams on behalf of the Vanguard Fund defendants. The remaining 3 minutes have been claimed by Mr. Nolan, who I believe has an additional introduction to make. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honor. Judge Durden, Your Honor. I would like to introduce my colleague from Foley Hoag in Boston, who has been admitted pro hac vice, Brandon White. Mr. White, I represent the Acadian and the Marathon defendants. Mr. White represents the Acadian defendants only. He will speak for 2 minutes on behalf of the Acadian defendants, and I will wrap up with a very quick chatter of 1 minute on behalf of the Marathon defendants separately.
All right, very well.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kevin Collins of the Bifferato firm, on behalf of the appellants. With me this morning is Thomas Sheridan of the Hanley Conroy firm in New York. Mr. Sheridan has been admitted pro hac vice, and with Your Honor's permission, will be arguing for appellants today.
Welcome, Mr. Sheridan.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. The fundamental issue in this case is whether financial institutions are required to obey the same rules that everyone else is that protect society from criminal enterprises. The essence of any investment is an attempt to profit from the underlying activity. And defendants' investment in illegal gambling was a deliberate attempt by them to profit from that criminal activity. That is not only contrary to bedrock common law principles, it's also illegal. The court below said that the defendants' investments could not possibly have been other than a legitimate exercise of business judgment. That is just plain wrong. If upheld, the rule announced by the court below would have serious adverse consequences, not just for investors, but for society as a whole.
But there's never really been a prosecution of passive investors?
There have not. But that doesn't, there has to be a first time for everything. As the court below, I think, correctly observed, but erroneously focused on, this activity wasn't possible when the Gambling Act was first enacted because you didn't have the Internet. The Gambling Act was enacted back in 1970.
But you had corporations and stockholders.
Well, the type of thing that happened here is unique because what you have here is foreign companies setting up overseas and exploiting the Internet in order to come into U.S. markets and violate our law. And there's absolutely no doubt, it's virtually undisputed, that what they were doing violated our law. And everybody knew it. The defendants knew it. They were told it was true in the prospectuses that they read. They deliberately exploited the illegal activity that was going on by these vultures over in foreign countries.
Is it essential to your position that this court find that the investment in these illegal online gambling establishments was itself illegal?
I think there are two prongs to that. Certainly, it is not essential. I certainly think it is correct that what they were doing was illegal. Not just what the gambling companies was doing that was illegal, but what these defendants were doing in owning the shares was illegal. It's just absolutely crystal clear under the statute.
You're saying it isn't essential.
And it is not essential because, as a matter of common law principles, it is also wrongful for one party knowingly to participate in and benefit from the wrongdoing of a third party. And that's a bedrock common law principle that carries through our entire jurisprudence. If I know somebody else is stealing from you, I'm not allowed to take the proceeds of that. Not allowed to profit from someone else's wrongdoing because
that certainly makes sense if you posit that that the so-called accomplice was engaging in the same illegal activity.
Yes.
But here we're talking about passive investors.
No.
So the question is whether your common law rule would even apply, and if it doesn't, then you're back to having to show that the investment itself constituted a violation of U.S. law.
I certainly do have to show that it is I think I can succeed under either branch. I think under both branches I win, because certainly it was a violation of U.S. law, and I submit to you, although there is no precedent because it's a relatively novel form of criminal activity, I submit to you that when a financial institution knowingly invests in a company whose principal purpose is to violate U.S. law, that's a violation of common law principles. That, as to the innocent investors who are mutual fund investors here, as to them, that activity is certainly imprudent. I think it was grossly negligent, a breach of fiduciary duty, and a waste of trust assets.
Well,
they are investing in criminal activities.
If the investors, through disclosure of the fund, become aware of this investment, are they too in violation of the law?
That is possible, yes, Your Honor, but highly unlikely, because investors in mutual funds usually don't get the kind of disclosures that these defendants had. These defendants had a prospectus that spelled out in over several pages that the activities in which they were investing were considered by the Department of Justice to be a violation of the Gambling Act, the RICO statute, the Wire statute, and a host of state laws, including the I don't know if they specifically mentioned Delaware, but they mentioned state law statutes. These defendants were told, they specifically focused on how this is an opportunity to get some profits on account of these people who figured out a way to evade prosecution because they're outside the bounds of U.S. jurisprudence. Well, the criminal enterprises gambled wrong when they ended up getting prosecuted, and the U.S. government was able to extend its reach in order to get them. But there's no reason why the plain language of the federal statute says that it's unlawful to own all or any part of an illegal business. They were clearly illegal businesses, and the defendants knew it. They are presumed to know the contents of the criminal law. The criminal law says you can't own it.
Well, if we adhere to at least the formalism of a corporate enterprise,
yes,
the actual ownership was by the corporate entities.
That's true. I don't think that's an important distinction, because the entity, the trust, the statutory trust, was caused to violate the federal statute. But in causing the trust to do that, these defendants violated, they were guilty as aiders and abettors, they were guilty as conspirators, they were guilty of causing the criminality of the company that they are responsible as fiduciaries for.
Under U.S. law, correct?
Under U.S. law, yes. That's
but there's
right.
no federal court that's ever held that.
No, I'm asking you to look at the plain language of a very clear and unambiguous statute. And the Vice Chancellor asked me that question below. Is there a precedent? No, there's not a precedent. But, you know, there has to be a first time for everything.
Is there a precedent the other way?
No, there's no precedent the other way either.
I mean, there's no federal court that's considered the question and rejected the argument either?
No. There have been courts that have considered that and kind of scratched their heads and said, I'm not so sure you're right, Mr. Sheridan. But there hasn't been any holding one way or another. And so I think it's incumbent upon this court, you know, the federal statutes are the supreme law of the land, and I realize this is a state court, and I'm asking you to look at a federal statute, but there's no reason why state courts can't interpret and apply the plain meaning of a federal statute. Now, the defendants have various exceptions that they'd like to sort of engraft upon the statute. They say, well, it was just passive activity. Well, ownership is a passive activity, but the statute prohibits ownership. Financing is basic.
Prosecutions were actually, you say they were actual prosecutions of these gambling entities?
Yes, the gambling entities have been individuals and entities themselves. Party gaming, for example, was pursued. They entered into a non-prosecution agreement where they admitted that they had violated the law and agreed to forfeit hundreds of millions of dollars. One of the founders of Party Gaming, he pled guilty, actually, not just a non-prosecution agreement with a forfeiture, but a guilty plea, and agreed to forfeit, I think it was $300 million. These have been very substantial criminal prosecutions.
In what court?
Well, the founder of Party Gaming pled guilty in the Southern District of New York, and the non-prosecution agreement with Party Gaming was entered into in the Southern District of New York. There have been prosecutions out in Missouri, and I'm just drawing a blank on where the others were located. And these companies in the non-prosecution agreements, they admit that they violated Section 1955. So there really is no dispute that the gambling companies are illegal gambling businesses. The only question they presented, and the question as to which the court below expressed doubt, was whether or not you can hold financial institutions responsible for saying, hey, wait a minute, that's an illegal company. Oh, is it okay to invest in that? You have to kind of scratch your head. What made them think that they could invest in a company? It would be one thing if the company incidentally happened to violate some U.S. statute as part of its business. But this isn't incidental. This is the core business. This is 80 to 90% of their revenues came from U.S. gamblers. The whole point of this criminal enterprise was to exploit U.S. individuals, to prey upon them. And these defendants knowingly decided that they would give mutual fund investors money to finance all of that. And why? What were they going to get out of it? Well, they'd get profits. Where would they get the profits? They'd get the profits from the illegal gambling in violation of U.S. law. How can you let them do that? It's just unconscionable. There's no exception in the statute that says, oh, well, if we're only a minor investor, that doesn't matter. There's no such exception in the statute. Congress knew how to create a minimum threshold of ownership. There are statutes where, I'm sorry.
If you're correct.
Yes.
Then which parties are primarily liable and which are secondarily, if any?
Well, I think at this stage of the case, you have to accept our complaint, which alleges that they are all equally culpable. Now, probably, as you get into discovery, it may be that it will turn out that some are more culpable than others. For example, the investment advisors who actually focused on all of this and, you know, read the prospectuses and gave the reports and recommended the purchase, maybe they're more culpable than others. But I don't see any real basis for distinguishing between anybody who is a fiduciary for these mutual funds who knew that the fund was investing in a company whose principal activity was it was violating the U.S. gambling laws, is culpable. Another fundamental common law principle is that everyone is presumed to know the criminal law. They can't run away from that. One of the things that the court below suggested is that, maybe they didn't know.
I asked a simple question.
Yes.
I mean, who's primarily liable? The funds are entities. They can't do anything unless human beings make them.
Right.
Does that mean that the individual defendants are the ones that are primarily liable? They're the ones that caused the investments to be made. Isn't that correct? At least according to your complaint.
That is correct.
And these also were the people that have raised the jurisdictional defense.
Some of them, yes.
If there is no personal jurisdiction over them, as the Vice Chancellor held, then and they are primarily liable, what then? Does the case go on in their absence?
Judge, I think if some of the defendants get out on the basis of no jurisdiction, the remaining defendants remain in the case, and it goes forward as to them. They're jointly and severally liable. That happens all the time. I'd like to turn my attention to the sort of what I guess I would regard as the second main point I'd like to focus on today. Just want to check my time. And that is the demand futility argument. The Delaware statute is pretty clear. It says you're allowed to bring a derivative action if a demand on the trustees is not likely to succeed. And that statute, I submit, basically embodies the common law rules and principles that this court has developed over many years and is embodied in Rails and Aronson. And I think it's pretty clear that as a matter of sort of common law principles, that you can't let the board of trustees of the mutual fund, which is 100% overlapping with the board of trustees of the defendant Vanguard, you can't let them make that decision. There's an irreconcilable conflict of interest. The mutual fund cannot be allowed to make a decision about whether to sue the investment advisor where the boards of the two entities are 100% the same. It's just an irreconcilable conflict. Furthermore, there is an irreconcilable conflict because there's a 100% overlap with all of the other mutual funds of Vanguard, which own Vanguard. So there's kind of a triple conflict here, because the trustees who supposedly would be the ones who you'd have to ask to bring the action, they're not going to bring the action because they're the trustees of the investment advisor, and they're also the trustees of all the other mutual funds that own the investment advisor. So it would be a terrible conflict of interest. Now, they don't really dispute that conflict exists or that it would disqualify under ordinary common law principles, but they say, we've put something in our declarations of trust, and in the declarations of trust, we've incorporated this, what I find to be an exceedingly confusing series of references from one statute, from the declaration to the statute to another statute.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time.
Yes, I understand. I just do want to finish this one point, and I respect that. The point is, they are not allowed. The Delaware statute does not authorize them to change the fundamental requirement of not likely to succeed. It does permit them to impose certain additional requirements, but it doesn't permit them to fundamentally change the statute. The legislature intended that if it was not likely to succeed, we'd be allowed to go forward. And their declaration is simply not authorized. And I see that I'm into my rebuttal, so I'll sit down. Thank you.
May it please the court, Amanda Davidoff for the trustees. Your Honors, demand was required in this case for the straightforward reason that plaintiffs did not satisfy the standards in the declarations of trust based on the definition of independence in the Trust Act for excusing demand. That ends the inquiry. If the court goes beyond the declarations of trust, there was no substantial likelihood of liability that would excuse demand, and plaintiff's contrary position is unprecedented. It would require the court to interpret a federal criminal statute in a way it has never been read by anyone, and it would require the court to find that independent trustees and apparently, according to today's presentation, mutual fund shareholders are criminally liable. And this is in a circumstance where there is not even a hint of self-interest on anyone's part. Turning to the declarations of trust, Section 3816 of the Trust Act authorizes statutory trusts to adopt, without limitation, additional standards and restrictions for when demand is excused or required. And that's part and parcel of Delaware policy in Section 3825 to give maximum effect to the enforceability of governing instruments of statutory trusts. Well, the trust did just that. They adopted an additional standard and restriction, which was that before a beneficial owner can bring a derivative action, he must show that a majority of the trustees were not independent, as that term is defined in the Trust Act. It's not confusing, it's very straightforward. The Trust Act defines independence by reference to the definition of interested person in the Investment Company Act of 1940. So the only question that needs to be answered is whether a majority of the trustees were interested persons under the Investment Company Act, and the Chancery Court correctly found that was not the case. Your Honors, plaintiffs do not make a serious attempt to dispute that a majority of the trustees were not interested persons under the Trust Act. They admit that a majority of the trustees were not interested persons for purposes of sitting on the board of a mutual fund. But they then go on.
Would they have an interest in not taking any action which suggests that they violated the criminal law?
There was no violation of the criminal law here.
So do we have to address that as part of this analysis?
You don't, Your Honor. For two reasons. First, because the declarations of trust are clear that if the trustees are not majority interested people, demand is required. And that has to be as defined in the Trust Act, which is in turn defines interested person by reference to the Investment Company Act definition. And by the way, the Trust Act says that if a trustee is independent under its definition, he's deemed independent and disinterested for all purposes. That's in 3801. So that's one reason that there's no need to reach that question.
And the definition under the Investment Company Act is, in a nutshell, what?
It is a multi-part definition, and that's actually a good thing. It's very flexible, and it can adapt to circumstances. The definition of an interested person is somebody who's an affiliated person of the investment company, and that means that it could be somebody who's controlled by, under common control with, or controls the investment company. Certain familial relationships would qualify, business relationships like having functioned as legal counsel. Principal and portfolio transactions with the investment company would also put somebody into that category. There then is a sort of catch-all flexible provision that allows the SEC to come in and say, you are interested by virtue of a material business or professional relationship. It would be tough to sum up, but that's the scheme that the Delaware legislature chose when it adopted that definition. And it makes a lot of sense because the Congress and the SEC are really expert regulators here who can consider all of these complicated issues and determine who's interested and who's not. The second reason that there's no need to reach that issue of whether the investments are illegal is because whether or not they were illegal, and they're clearly not, and I'm happy to address that as well, plaintiffs were required to allege a substantial likelihood of liability to allege that the trustees knew they were illegal. And that's what the Chancery Court found, and Vice Chancellor Parsons was correct. Under the business judgment rule, it's not enough if an action that a company takes just turns out to be illegal. That won't subject a trustee who approved that action to personal liability. In Caremark, for example, the trustees knew about the contracts with healthcare providers that were eventually determined to violate federal law, the anti-referral payments law, subjecting the company to $50 million in liability. There's, of course, been no enforcement action against Vanguard or liability for Vanguard based on this conduct. But, you know, there in Caremark, the court found it was very unlikely that the trustees would be found liable for having approved those contracts because they did not know at the time that the contracts were illegal. Similarly, this court's decision in Wood versus Baum, where the financial statements explicitly approved by the directors of the company turned out to violate SEC rules. They had misstated the value of non-performing assets and charitable contributions. There was also a Caremark claim in that case, arguing that the trustees had negligently failed to ensure that there were adequate controls in place. But the court found demand was not excused because there were no particularized allegations that the trustees knew of this illegality. And the same is true here. Now, one thing that was not mentioned in the...
Well, the other side would say the prospectus had it all over it, that these were illegal in the United States.
It's certainly true that it was known that gambling companies could be illegal in the United States under United States law. What was not known, as Vice Chancellor Parsons found, was that passive minority investments in publicly traded gambling companies traded on the London and Vienna stock exchanges could violate the law. That was not known by anyone. It's not known by anyone to this day. It would be remarkable for this court to find that the trustees should have known in 2005 and 2006 that those passive minority investments of no more than 0.26% of any of the gambling companies at issue in this case could have violated the law. And there's a complete lack of enforcement of this statute, as was mentioned. And, Your Honors, that is significant. The Chancery Court in the Litt decision faced a similar situation where a plaintiff was trying to show that, make a new argument, that certain payments to employees of a bank violated the bank bribery law. That was something that had never been determined by any court. And the Chancery Court found in those circumstances where no enforcement authority had apparently thought that conduct to fall within the statute or to be worthy of enforcement, it would be improper for a Delaware court to determine that, in fact, the conduct was illegal. And that, now, the exculpatory provisions that the declarations of trust include are also important here, and they're another reason why the court doesn't need to reach the issue of whether the investments actually were illegal. The exculpatory provisions provide that the trustees cannot be liable for any conduct that was not willful misfeasance, gross negligence, bad faith, reckless disregard of duty. And so, again, plaintiffs would be required to plead with particularity that the trustees either knew that the investments were illegal or that their oversight of investments was so negligent that it amounted to bad faith. And they certainly haven't pled that the trustees knew the conduct was illegal, because they haven't pled that anybody knew those investments were illegal, and they haven't pled anything to suggest that the trustees' oversight was inadequate. They plead the opposite. They plead that the trustees delegated investment decisions to professional managers and monitored those managers' activities. So, you know, there is really no need to reach that issue of whether the investments were illegal, because even if they were, there's no substantial likelihood of liability here. But
does the record disclose whether or not at the time these investments in the gambling companies were made, those responsible for the investment were aware that at least it was being argued by somebody that the passive investment would be illegal?
There's nothing that suggests that in the record, because it was not being argued by anybody at that time that passive investments were illegal. That's the answer. I mean, in fact, in the prospectuses that the plaintiffs cite, there are pages and pages of legal risks that the company is disclosing to its investors. Party gaming is disclosing to its investors. Nowhere does it disclose that an investor could be facing personal legal liability for buying those securities. And these are, you know, very detailed.
Criminal liability.
Pardon, criminal liability, exactly. Now, if the court were to reach the issue of whether the investments are illegal, as I've already mentioned, there's been no enforcement of this statute in the way that plaintiffs ask this court to enforce it. The purpose of the statute was to reach companies that and individuals that systematically prey on our citizens by means of continuous and substantial conduct with assistance from corrupt officials. And that's important context for what that statute means. That word own has to be read in that context, in the context of the words that surround it in the statute. Direct, manage, supervise, finance, all words that denote some kind of participation or influence over the gambling business, and passive minority investments just do not match up. And Your Honors, when Congress intended to criminalize passive minority investments in public companies, it has said that explicitly and knows how to say that. It said that in the RICO statute, Section 1962, enacted at the same time as Section 1955. That statute makes it illegal to invest, and it uses the word invest, in businesses in interstate commerce, invest racketeering proceeds in businesses in interstate commerce. There, of course, does not appear the word invest in the statute we're talking about here, Section 1955. Now, there are several other reasons why the plaintiffs haven't alleged a substantial likelihood of liability here. First, plaintiffs allege that the trustees delegated investment decisions to professional managers, and both under the declarations of trust and under Section 3322 of the Trust Act, unless plaintiffs allege that the delegation was negligent or the monitoring of the advisors was negligent, they can't state a claim for liability based on investment decisions. Also, there are very clear requirements for alleging a claim based on investment decisions, also in the Trust Act. That's in Section 3302. A plaintiff must allege the performance of the portfolio, the other securities in the portfolio, the purposes of the portfolio, and show that the investment at issue was inappropriate in light of all of that information. Well, Your Honors, plaintiffs don't allege anything about the portfolio to suggest that these investments were inappropriate. And to the contrary, investing in a company that makes up part of an index is quite appropriate for an index fund. That's what the European Index Fund is. It's an index fund. Investing in a company traded on the London and Vienna Stock Exchange seems quite appropriate for a fund that's called the Global Equity Fund. So for those separate reasons, plaintiffs also haven't established that there could be a substantial likelihood of liability for these trustees. I'd like, if I may, to go back to this issue of interestedness and just explain. I think we had started to discuss whether there was some conflict raised by the proposition of the trustees being asked to sue VGI, the Vanguard Group, Inc. And the answer is no, first for the reason I discussed, because the declarations of trust, which are binding pursuant to the Trust Act, say that unless a majority of the trustees are interested persons under the 40 Act, demand is not excused. But second, because there really is no conflict created by the trustees being asked to sue VGI. If the trustees were asked to sue VGI, they're not really adverse in that lawsuit. As plaintiffs allege, the costs of VGI are paid by all of the Vanguard funds across the group. And so the question really is whether the trustees could disinterestedly consider a demand to take some action that arguably could have some adverse effect on the other funds in the group. Well, that's a question that has already been answered several times by multiple authorities. First, the General Assembly in Section 3801 said that service on multiple boards of funds in a family does not create any sort of lack of interestedness or lack of independence. Second, the SEC in the 1999 Investment Company Act release interpreted its own rules and regulations to mean that there is no lack of independence or lack of interestedness created by multiple service on multiple funds and boards of multiple funds in a family. Third, courts to consider this issue in the demand futility context have held that service on boards of multiple funds in a family does not create any lack of independence. And they've even considered that in the context of claims that bringing a suit in that, bringing a suit.
Counsel, your time is up.
Oh, I apologize. We ask that you affirm. Thank you.
May it please the court. We heard nothing from Mr. Sheridan today about personal jurisdiction over the non-trustee individual defendants, and for good reason. It does not exist here. Let me begin with plaintiff's conspiracy theory. The court below correctly rejected this theory as conclusory, and plaintiffs do nothing to challenge this finding. Plaintiffs do not, because they cannot, point to any well-pled allegations of fact establishing the who, what, where, when, why, or how of any conspiracy. There simply are no such facts pled anywhere in the record. Let me turn to Section 3104C3. First, the court below correctly rejected plaintiff's argument that the non-trustee individual defendants are subject to jurisdiction here because the Delaware funds allegedly own securities in purportedly illegal gambling businesses. The court below correctly found that subsection C3 required plaintiffs to make a factual showing that a tangible act actually take place in Delaware, and plaintiffs had failed to do so. Plaintiffs cite no authority for their novel metaphysical ownership theory, and we are aware of none. The one case that they point to, Sample v. Morgan, is to the contrary. There, the court held that even if a metaphysical injury occurs here, there still must be a tangible physical act in the state. And Sample had that, the filing of a certificate of amendment with the Secretary of State. Finally, plaintiffs make the unprecedented or unsupported claim that defendants do not dispute that a fund must be deemed to own its securities in its place of incorporation. But the individual defendants do dispute this proposition. Plaintiffs offer no authority for their assertion that, and indeed there, I don't believe there is any, that each of the allegedly that the act of ownership of securities in these foreign companies occurs in Delaware. Indeed, the more logical answer is that the act of owning shares in these foreign entities occurs in the jurisdictions in which they are domiciled, as under Section 169 of our corporate law.
Mr. Lafferty, I'm sorry, but you're...
Yes, thank you. In sum, we believe that the courts should be affirmed. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Brandon White, and I represent Acadian Asset Management, LLC, and its employees, Ronald Frazier, John Chisholm, and Brian Wallaham. The Chancery Court correctly concluded that these individuals did not consent to its jurisdiction just by working for a Delaware LLC. The Delaware Limited Liability Company Act provides that a manager may be served with civil process in all actions involving or relating to the business of the limited liability company or a violation by the manager of a duty to the limited liability company or to a member. This statute, by its terms, does not apply here. There is no allegation in this case of any violation of a duty to the LLC or to a member. And as the Chancery Court explained, this is not an action involving or relating to the business of the LLC. The Chancery Court followed precedent in ruling that the statute refers to the LLC's internal business and to the manager's act of managing that business, not to the provision of outside services, as we have in today's case. To read the statute otherwise would run afoul of the Due Process Clause, as LLC managers could be swept within its terms, even though they have no reasonable expectation of being hailed into court in Delaware. Today's case is a perfect example, as Frazier, Chisholm, and Wallahan have no contacts whatsoever with Delaware, and they have done nothing that implicates the state's interest in regulating the internal affairs of its LLCs. Now, if the court were to adopt plaintiff's expansive interpretation of the act, no one would form an LLC in Delaware, and no one would want to be a manager of one. The Chancery Court correctly rejected that reading, and its decision should be affirmed.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I rise only briefly on behalf of the Marathon defendants to adopt the arguments of our fellow appellees. On the jurisdictional point, I would add that the arguments apply with special force to Mr. Osterer, who is a UK resident working for a UK firm in the UK with no relevant contacts to Delaware. On the demand point, the third party Marathon and Acadian defendants stand at an even further remove than the Vanguard trustees. As to these third parties, the complaint alleged no demand-related conflicting interest to suggest any doubt that the Vanguard trustees, if so inclined, could take action against these third parties. The opinion below is correct in so holding, and, Your Honor, it should be affirmed. Thank you.
May it please the Court again. Ms. Davidoff said that the complaint doesn't allege that they knew what they were doing was illegal. The complaint is not required to allege that they knew what they were doing was illegal because everyone is presumed to know the law. She referred to the Caremark decision as having some bearing on the culpability of the directors. I would point out to you that, or remind this court, that in Caremark, Caremark was a settlement where the court was evaluating the potential, the viability of the lawsuit in order to evaluate the fairness of the settlement, and got into a judgment about, well, what might happen if the case goes forward. And what the court did was it focused on the fact that the directors there had sought the advice of counsel. When the directors in that case had a question about the application of the law, they sought advice of counsel, and so they had a viable, or at least what the court thought might be a viable, advice of counsel defense. They haven't raised anything like that. There's no suggestion in the record that anybody even paused to consider possibly asking a lawyer whether or not the actions they were about to take would violate federal law. Would-be bomb was also cited. Would-be bomb involved extremely complex and somewhat esoteric accounting standards where the court basically said it's not fair to take trustees and hold them to essentially the standards of an expert in accounting matters. You have to know what the facts are. You have to know what the accounting standards say. It's complicated. And so that's a fundamentally different situation than one where you know that you're investing in illegal companies, and the only question is, well, is that legal or not? And all you have to do is look at the statute that says it's illegal to own an illegal gambling business, and the light has to go off. At a minimum, they had to go running to counsel. If they don't have didn't get advice of counsel on that one, I just can't imagine trustees being anything other than incredibly reckless. Now, much has been made about this point about passive, you know, it's just a passive investment. It's just a passive investment. Ownership is a passive investment. The Godfather is just a passive investor. He's got all his minions doing stuff for him. Congress said, we don't want you to be owning all or any part. It's malum prohibitum. You're not allowed to own illegal gambling businesses. And these businesses, that's all they did. That's all they did. 80-90% of their business was all gambling, but it was mostly U.S. gambling.
Now, what's your response to the failure to use the word invest?
It doesn't matter. It who cares? The statute says own, and they owned. A corporation is owned by its shareholders. You're supposed to apply the plain language, common meaning of a federal statute.
And the business was owned by the corporation, right?
The illegal gambling businesses were corporations. And by purchasing their stock, the mutual fund became an owner of its shares and therefore an owner of the business within the common meaning of ownership. Otherwise, you'd be able to say, well, I could set up some kind of a corporation to sell narcotics and everybody could buy shares in my company, and that would be okay because you're not you don't actually own the narcotics business. You're just shareholders. What is that about? That's what shareholders do. They provide the funding necessary to finance the enterprise. That's what stockholdership, in addition to providing funds to the entity to exist and to flourish, I'm sorry, I see my time has expired, but if I may finish that sentence, they also serve the purpose of funneling profits to the investor shareholders, which is what they're not supposed to do. Thank you very much for your time.
The court is grateful to counsel for their well-delivered arguments. We will, of course, take this case under advisement, and we will take a brief recess.